now.
11 L-R and I. Now the lights dim low. Soon we'll start the show. Here comes L.F. Midwood.
If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung, would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand-me-down. The thoughts are broken. Perhaps they're better left unsung. I don't know. Don't really care. Let there be songs to fill the air. Rippled in still water, when there is no pebble tossed, nor wind to blow, reach out your hand. If your cup be empty, if your cup is full, may it be again. Let it be known there is a fountain that was not made by the hands of men. There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night. And if you go, no one may follow. That path is for your steps alone. When there is no pebble tossed, no wind to blow, you choose to lead, must follow. But if you fall, you fall alone. If you should stand, then who's to guide you? If I knew the way, I would take you home. La da da da, la da 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 da da, la da.
Yeah, you know, whenever I play, Grateful Dead, which isn't enough, by the way, I always tend to play, if I can, I play a studio cover, because I know the vast majority of my listenership just isn't into the Dead, and they'll probably get more out of a studio cut than they would out of a live cut. I even remember having that. I forget exactly what the situation was, but I was actually on the phone with John Lightning maybe a half hour before one of these shows over the last 5 years, and I was talking to him, and I said, I'm gonna play I forget what it was. I forget what Dead song it was, but I said, I want to play a Dead song. And so I'm like, which live version do you think I should play? Because, you know, John Lydon is, he's knowledgeable of, on such matters, you know? He said to me, just play the studio version. Yeah, you'll get as much out of the studio version as anything else, you know? So yeah, that was a great for that. That was Ripple from American Beauty. The reason, by the way, my name is LF Midwood and you're listening to the Midwood Files. The reason I'm playing, I guess I could have played a track off of anything. I could have played from Animoxia. I could have played something from Alive Dead, that first Alive Dead album. I could have even, if I had really been feeling kind of spry, played some new Riders of the Purple Sage, because the gentleman that I'm going to mention who was passed, was their original bassist. Bob Matthews, has passed away. Some of you may not know who he is, but he was a musician, but he did more studio engineering for them. Some of you may or may not recall Betty and Bob, that mixing board duo, famous dynamic duo. That's the Bob out of Betty and Bob. Betty's still kicking, but she was in her teens. She was like a teenager when she got started setting up stuff for them. Maybe there's a little quick thing I can read on. There's, like I said, playing Ripple was, you know, by no way doing this man justice. Let's see. The various members, Dan Healy and some were recorded. A team of Bob Matthews and Betty Cantor. While Practical Matter was a little bit more of a crossover in terms. Okay, so they originally started, say, for a few outsiders. So they basically did up into various retirements, because I think Matthew stopped in 2002, but on and off. They're best known for engineering and mixing live Grateful Dead projects, first and most famously Live/Dead. But other album projects as well. Betty Cantor, of course, achieved Deadhead immortality for her beautiful live recordings of Jerry Garcia and Grateful Dead and others. We're going to talk about Betty here for a sec. To most Deadheads, a Betty board is a gold standard for live field recordings, which is really cool. However, the team of Matthews and Betty, she got married, so it was no longer, it was Cantor. Okay, she was, her maiden name was Cantor. Her married name is Cantor Jackson. Because it says, however, the team of Matthews and Cantor had a lengthy track of recording studio projects as well, and those mostly got second billing to their deservedly famous live recordings. The purpose of this post is to create a running tab of Bob and Betty studio projects, whether directly associated with the Dead or not. So they did do a little other stuff. And this is just a little tiny little. Bob Matthews was a friend of Bob Weir's from Menlo Park. He had attended Peninsula School, K-8 with Weir, John Dawson, Steve Marcus, and others. John Dawson may sound familiar to you as the lead singer from New Riders of Purple Sage. Although Weir's checkered academic history meant that he attended numerous schools, which is funny. When the Grateful Dead started, Matthews worked his way into the gang as a sound engineer, initially focusing on live sound. But he seemed to have been fired in December of 67 and shipped home to the Grateful Dead's Eastern, shipped home from the Grateful Dead's Eastern tour. That's funny. Only in The Dead, however, does it appear that you can be fired from the band's crew and spend the next 15 years recording their albums. After his departure, Matthews eventually migrated to studio duties. He helped Owsley build the Carousel of Sound in early 68. That was the big wall sound thing that The Dead had always been evolving. And later, Matthews seemed to have been the central to the whole Alembic enterprise begun by Owsley, Ron Rixor, and Rick Turner. He's thoroughly integrated into Grateful Dead history and law. And American Beauty was just one of the albums that he mixed down. So I believe he was in New Riders, the earliest incarnation of the. I don't play any New Riders. I should. The earliest incantation, I'm really in a Deadhead kind of mood, incarnation, if you will. He was in the earliest. I think he played bass, and I think he actually shared bass duties with Phil Lesh, and then Lesh was like, eh. And then then he was doing it himself, and then the new writers evolved like a lot, so it's kind of hard. But definitely that first album, I think from, I'm not quite sure if it's 69 or 70, but that first album. I happen to like my new writers live. I like that, the live stuff. The studio stuff's good, don't get me wrong. But the live stuff, for some reason, with them, just kind of resonates with me a little bit better. There's a lot of stuff, when I first started listening to the Grateful Dead, I only listened to studio. Because I really didn't have any, or whatever live tracks were available, whatever live albums were available, because I didn't have any access to anything other than that. And then as I evolved and met people, I got to meet people who had live recordings, and I was able to get real, you know, live shows on tape or whatever media at the time to be able to listen to. So yeah, and I enjoyed that a lot. I guess I don't talk about being a Deadhead much because, you know, I have, I know I've said this numerous times, I have Ace's album, and he I believe he mixed down Ace, too, so this is actually Bob Matthews mixed down Ace, or at least was involved with that engineering process, Ace being Bob Weir's first solo album. I have the cover of it, the girl from the cover in her shoe tattooed on my left, I think it's my left shoulder blade, I forget, because there's something else on my right shoulder blade, I'm getting old, but it's really I don't know how to explain it, really. It's a difficult thing to explain. Either it's kind of like scotch, and I don't like scotch. So, like, you know, I mean, the Grateful Dead are like, kind of like scotch. And, you know, I've had this ongoing thing with, not, I wouldn't say ongoing, but, you know, it comes up between John and I. You know, John's a long-time Deadhead. And he's, you know, a lot of friends, a lot of shows, you know, which is, I have utmost respect for that. I didn't start with the Dead until, like, 85. So he had a long, and I didn't go to shows. I didn't go to a lot of shows. Not as many as John Lydon did, for sure. But when Jerry died, and that's going to be, you know, I talk about like 9/11. I'm going to remember where I was in 9/11. And I'm going to remember where I was when Jerry Garcia died, for the rest of my life. Just a fact. And I had numerous phone calls from people on that day to my phone, on my cell phone, because I was at work. And since then, I've really, and I might have talked about this before, I don't know, I'm on drugs. I've really stayed away from a lot of the other Dead-related projects, because they're not the Grateful Dead. Phil Lesh and Friends is not the Grateful Dead. Dead & Company is not the Grateful Dead. The other ones were not the Grateful Dead. The Dead are not even the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead are the Grateful Dead, and the Grateful Dead came to an end in 1995. And I haven't listened. I really have gone out of my way. I was never into any of the other jam bands, you know, Fish or my Wiki's on Fire or whatever the hell they are. You know, I was just wasn't my thing, man. Just not, no, not really. I kind of always, I always stick to like real Grateful Dead. And as I've pointed out to everybody who says I'm missing a lot of great music, my reply to them is that there's so much great Grateful Dead music that I haven't even gotten to yet. Because I don't listen to them exclusively. I listen to other stuff, and I don't listen to them all the time. I go through phases. I stop. He's back. I listen. So there's enough live Grateful Dead music that I haven't heard to keep me in Grateful Dead music for the rest of my friggin' life. So why do I have to go and listen to, apparently Bob Weir does things at this fucking crazy slow tempo. I don't want to mess with that. I don't want to hear Bob Weir singing Jerry Garcia songs as lead. I don't want to hear it. And I have no interest in that. None whatsoever. And I love Bob Weir. I mean, how do you not love the Ace? I mean, honestly, but I have no desire to do that. I just don't. I understand people wanting to keep the music alive. I respect that. You know, I look around on Facebook, and it boggles my little mind that there's a whole generation of Deadheads that are like they weren't even born when I started listening to the Great. I guess the old timers can say that, but I never considered myself to be an old timer. You know what I mean? I never considered myself to be. An old, I never really did, not for nothing. I worked with guys like John and the two Jeffs and, you know, other people that I know as old timers, dude. you know? Like old timers. Me? No. Whippersnapper. But there's a whole generation out there, and that's great. And you know, I think I heard one Phil Leshen song. I think I played it. I forget what it was. I forget the name of the song, but it had a lot of cool guitars in it and whatnot. And that's cool, you know. But I wouldn't, you know, I couldn't pick it out of a lineup. You know what I mean? Because I just don't regularly frequent the new stuff. But you know, what are you gonna do? I mean, you know. John Mayer gets a lot of, I think a lot of people are less than pleased with him for whatever the reason. I don't know. I haven't listened to him play those particular parts. So I don't really, it's just weird. It would be weird right now because I exclusively listen to Grateful Dead pre 95 or 95 or older, I should say. Because of that, if I were to hear like New Dead, it would be jarring to me because I haven't had those from 95 to now years to kind of adjust to what everybody else is doing. You know, I haven't even heard the stuff from the Farewell Chicago show. My understanding is they picked that for the Farewell tour because that's the last show that Jerry played, right? I think he didn't die there, but it's the last show that he played. I saw him at Meadowlands with Dylan opening. It might have been that same tour that same year. It might have been like the I don't remember when in 95, but it was definitely 95. So if I saw him in 95, I mean, if I saw the Grateful Dead in 95, Jerry must have been still playing. So I saw him with Dylan, and you know, it sucked because the sound system wasn't so great. And I always wanted to see him. I'd never gotten a chance to see him with Dylan because I wasn't able to get into any of those Dylan and Dead shows when they did that album back, don't even remember when, 88 maybe. I wasn't able to get in there and get any tickets to see that. So I always wanted to see them together because I always, you know, that's like peanut butter and jelly. To a certain degree, it's like peanut butter and jelly. So, yeah, you know, I was watching a lot of the posts, you know, in regards to Bob's passing there. And, yeah, people are feeling old. People are feeling old. I guess at 51, I'm mature, I guess. Like if in cat years, I would consider to be an adult cat. Still an adult cat. My cat and I have had this conversation this morning, as a matter of fact, or this afternoon. Actually, this evening, I woke up at 7 o'clock. Horrible, horrible, horrible. I know. I did get up early a couple other days though, for no specific reason, I don't think. But I was up before like noon, I think, at least one day last week. So it's like if I could do that once a week, I can still consider myself to be like, you know, it's okay. You know, don't worry. Don't worry about what they might be thinking about you. So, yeah, I feel I should play more. Every time I play to Dead, I'm like, yeah, I should just play more Dead. And then I would play Dead all the time and it would be like, oh, he has to stop playing Dead. Jeez, I've always been weary of that because I know that people don't dig the Dead. It's just a vast majority of people. It's a very small percentile. It's like maybe 5% of the people that I've ever met like the Dead. There's maybe another 5 that would like it could for a little while, and then it starts to go do, and it kind of gets them, you know. So it's pretty much 5%, and you know, when it's there's a couple of good books. My books, you know, my ex-wife, she stole my tie-dyes, and she stole all my good Dead books. She left like maybe one, all my good Dead books. And she doesn't even like the Grateful Dead. I've told this story. I must have told this story about how that was that last show, as a matter of fact. Now that I think of it, of going to see Jerry and the Dead, you know, and the Dead. And I'm thinking Dylan and the Dead, excuse me, with Dylan opening. And you know, she got the ticket. She got the ticket. She's all excited and shit, right? So we get there, and it's like, you know, we both get out of work early. Oh, we go to Meadowlands. Oh, okay, we go to Meadowlands. We get there, and I'm just like, oh God, Meadowlands. Now I'm perfectly sober, and I'm getting like randomly drug tested, so I can't even really smoke, anyways. You know, so it doesn't really matter. So you know, and not for nothing, to me, although it may not always seem like it, to Dead wasn't always about drugs. I mean, music will enhance anything. You know, music will definitely enhance the Grateful Dead. Do not get me wrong, but they are amazing without you know any sort of chemical increasement, for lack of a better word, chemical enhancement. So anyway, back to the, we get there, and then sitting there, and okay, then come out, and Dylan comes out, and it's like, the PA's like, and it's like, you know, he sounds kind of like a cat, a little like a cat. Maybe I have cats on the brain, so maybe I'm just remembering it that way. And I love Dylan, don't get me wrong. And so he goes in, all right, and we both look at each other, and we're like, well, we saw Dylan open for the Dead, you know? And then the Dead come out, and, you know, it's pretty typical 1995 Dead. I mean, you know, it's come out, you're setting, do a lot of people there, good vibes. You know, it's Meadowlands, so everything's tightened up, you know. But it's good vibes, you know, it's all right. And, you know, so in a half hour, 45 minutes, about an hour, you know, I can see her getting antsy. I know the ex-wife antsy shit, you know, you live with someone long enough, you know the antsy stuff, you know. So she's getting a little antsy. So they, you know, they go in the fucking, do a little break, and then the drums, here comes drums, and she looks like she has to go to the bathroom, only she doesn't. So she's like, no, I don't know, it's about an hour and a half, maybe. She's like, I want to go home. I'm like, what? She's like, I want to go home. I'm like, I can't believe you dragged me out here to a Dead show and making me go home after 90 minutes because I want to go home. So I took her home and I didn't talk to her for 3 days. Unbelievable. See, this is what happens when people are just like into the artwork. You know, or quote unquote the hits, like the Grateful Dead ever had a hit. But yeah, I guess they did. I guess that Touch of Grey. As a matter of fact, I think older Deadheads, there's this delineation line between when Touch of Grey came out, and you know, the In the Dark album, I suppose. When In the Dark came out and Touch of Grey began to get played and was like a hit. It hit top 40. It might even have cracked top 10. I'm not even 100% sure, but everybody heard that fucking song at one point in time. So there's a whole bunch of people who got into the Dead after that song, you know. So I think, you know, it's just like the hooligans, the young, and they're always accused of like fucking up the scene and whatnot. So I guess my ex-wife would qualify as one of those. And yet still, she took my Dead books and my friggin' tie-dyes when she left. And yes, she did leave. So how do you like that? Just the way it goes. But, you know, I'm always going to... I always make time for the Grateful Dead. You always, it's one of these things I guess I have, like, because of my teen years, I know everybody knows I took shit for not being into, like, death metal, you know, or like, you know, hardcore, let's hit each other with fire axes type shit. You know, I was like, yeah, okay, that's all right. You know, there's a place for that. I understand, but. You know, I was always into the Beatles, the Dead, a lot of the 60s stuff, you know, and some of the 70s as well. Don't get me wrong. I always took shit from people. Always. And now they're playing that stuff for their kids. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I never said that. And it's like, you know what? All righty then. Fuck you and the fucking horse you rode in on as you go through the desert. And I bet the horse has no name. Okay. All right. Now that we've squared that away. Anyway. I got some news. So Godspeed, Bob Matthews. Godspeed. Let's see. Tomorrow, Providence, mostly sunny, 74-52. It is cooling off. It's fall. It's officially fall, by the way. I just want to mention this before I get too involved. I had a cigar on the Equinox there, and it was nice. I hadn't had one. I stopped and think about it. I hadn't had a cigar for a while because I don't smoke a lot of them. And then it's usually like an event kind of deal. And then I remember I took some cigars with me in my my airproof humidor thing to New Jersey to go see Pinball Wizard. And we never smoked them. They were in my suitcase. So I finally got around them back in my suitcase the other day. Yeah, that's right. And... I pulled out a cigar and I was on the porch and just chilling and, you know, listening to the gunshots off in the distance and smelling all the dog pee and just the wonderful smells of Elmwood and thinking to myself that, you know, next Halloween, Equinox, first day of fall, whatever the season, it's a season for me, you know, it's a season. No, speaking of which, you know, Elvira, I'm a pretty big Elvira fan, as is any heterosexual male who grew up in that era. And so I've been a big Elvira fan for a while. Since I know she retired, and then she came back, and you know, I've seen both movies multiple times, and you know, the stuff that she does in commentary. She did the 13 Days of Hulu a couple, few years ago, 5-6 years ago. So I'm an Elvira fan, you know. The character is great, you know. Cassandra Peterson pulls it off very, very greatly. She's a Zachary of my generation, because there is a Zachary. I don't know, if you start explaining like spooky movie radio hosts, it's going to take all night. But Zachary was a guy on the East Coast that some of you on the East Coast may remember. I didn't have him. You know, he was already in waning by the time that I was around, you know. And we didn't have that Svengoolie dude, because that didn't happen. He's in Chicago. I mean, there was no internet, you know. But somehow Elvira managed to punch through. From, I guess, being in a station in Los Angeles really helped. But she managed to punch through and become a national, you know, she was known nationally. And this is pre-internet. To be known nationally pre-internet was a big deal, you know, not for nothing. Yeah. And she was like she's friends with Pee Wee, you know, Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman. And I forget the guy who was a writer who was both a friend of theirs who died recently. He was the genie in the mirror on Pee-wee's Playhouse. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but incredibly talented. Anyway, he died not that long ago. So she was putting out a book. It's like the 40th anniversary of Elvira. So that would mean she was like 11, which makes sense if you stop and think about it when I go about my age group. See, talking about that age group. So she's been hyping it here, because I follow her on Twitter. I follow her on what's the other one? Instagram and Facebook, just to make sure I don't miss any announcements. So she's been hyping the book, which is great. You know, I want to get a copy of it eventually. And so the book, right before the book comes out, or it came out or whatnot, there's this big thing, like this last week. There's a segment in the book where she talks about how she's been in a 19-year relationship with another woman. She was married, and she got she was married and had a kid. I know she has a daughter, and she got divorced. And that was like when because the husband was the manager. And I think she was like, when she was talking about retirement, she was talking about having someone replace her. I thought they had a contest and someone replaced her. And the daughter was running the empire, kind of like Hugh Hefner, kind of almost. Yeah. Only a lot less boobs, but still kind of like that. And it turns out she got divorced, and she's been shacking up with another woman. So she's a lesbian. But, you know, I have to wonder, you know, because it's really funny, because how many of her gags involve chasing guys, which is, you know, I guess it's just a spiel. Obviously, of course, it's just humor. But if she was heterosexual and she was married and she had a child, right? And then she got into women later. And now, is she really a lesbian now? Isn't she more bisexual? Aren't there lesbians who don't have anything to do with men ever? I mean, aren't there like strict standards for that sort of thing? Aren't there? And if there aren't, shouldn't there be? Honestly, let's give this a thought for a moment. All right. So that being said, yeah, I'm kind of a little, I don't know, as long as she's happy. You know, she was always big on the gay rights thing. So, you know. You know, the goth thing is, that's really, you know, you start to look around and it gets a little weird there. So we'll just leave it at that. And I always considered her obviously very gothy. Queen of Halloween. Yep. Anyway, I'm going to be sad when she dies. Her birthday just passed. She's like 70. See, that goes to show, that's the producer and I were having that conversation. That goes to show what the tape and the makeup can do. You know, and she's been wearing the makeup so long that you don't really know. Do you know what I mean? So you take, you know, you just a little bit more makeup, a little bit more of whatever they were using to make that happen, and it stays. So, and, you know, that's that. So, not news. I didn't have an Elvira story. It was all off the top of my brain pan, but I want to remember and I think that she was premiering something on Shudder tonight, on the Shudder channel, some sort of anniversary show, I think. I'm not 100% sure. I'll have to have to look into it. I think it aired early tonight, so you might want to look for it elsewhere on the internet. I'm going to see if I can get it off the news groups at some point in time. Hopefully, it will warrant somebody having ripped it off. That being said, let's see. What do I got? I don't even really feel like doing any news, but I can do news for like a half hour. Sure, I can. Okay. Let me start with this. This was a letter from the president, from President Trump, sent to, and I grabbed this off the D.C. Patriot, but this was an open letter. Letter from the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, to Texas Governor Greg Abbott on audits. Okay, the following letter is from the 45th President of the United States. Okay. Here we go. Despite my big win in Texas, I hear Texans want an election audit. You know your fellow Texans have a big questions about the November 2020 elections. Bills to audit elections in your great state House and Senate were considered during Texas's second special session. Instead, the legislature passed a watered-down amendment that doesn't even apply to the 2020 presidential election. This short amendment doesn't answer the questions Texans have about the last election. Texans wanted a real audit to completely address their concerns. We need HB 16, which was to be filed in the third session. This legislation specifically addresses the 2020 presidential election and enables audits for future elections. The bill creates a process for candidates and party chairs to initiate an audit and uses the same language as SB 97, which already passed the Texas State Senate, but didn't have enough time to make it through the House during the special second session. Texans need you to act now. Your third special session is the perfect and maybe last opportunity to pass this audit bill. The time is running out. Paper ballots in your state are only kept for 22 months after the election. Your citizens don't trust the election system, and they want your leadership on this issue, which is the number one thing they care about. It is the most important issue, one that will affect 2022 and 2024. Governor Abbott, we need a forensic audit of the 2020 election added to the call. We're quickly running out of time, and it must be done this week. Texans know voting fraud occurred in some of your counties. Let's get to the bottom of the 2020 presidential election scam, Donald J. Trump. That was this week. Let's see. September 25th is when that hit the when that was released. I don't know how many. I don't think you're going to see that on CNN, and I don't know how many other places. Decided they're opted to talk about that. Let me see what I got here. I wanted to get this last week. Texas's. I got Elvira on the brain. Texas's. Okay. And Daily Caller doesn't want me to open. All right. Well, the gist of this, because it's going to close again on me. The judge presiding over the case, over the Rittenhouse case there, you know, the kid who was defending himself in, was that Wisconsin? Or did he cross the border into the other, who really cares, state? I'm not even really sure. He's not tied to any far-right groups, which all the far-right groups already knew. We already knew that. But apparently there's been info passed along, and now everybody else knows that, according to the media. So thanks for that. Is this one going to close on me? This is the Examiner. Clinton indictment blows Russia collusion conspiracy wide open, top GOP investigator says. All right. The cybersecurity lawyer indicted this week, and this was the 17th. The cybersecurity lawyer indicted this week by a grand jury and a special counsel John Durham's investigation, nice to see something come of that, could end up being the fall guy for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign warned a top House Republican. Republican David Nunes, the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, told Newsmax on Thursday there is evidence of a broad Russia collusion conspiracy. Allegations the congressman seems investigated and referred to the Justice Department, the top department. But Nunes cautioned that the Clintons have a long history of their lawyers and agents disappearing. Michael Sussman, a former attorney at Perkins Coie, is accused of falsely telling the top FBI lawyer he was not representing any clients when acting on behalf of a technology executive and the Clinton campaign during a September 2016 meeting on possible links between former President Donald Trump and Russia. Sussman pleaded not guilty to a charge of lying to the FBI on Friday, with lawyers insisting he never said he didn't have any clients and he was representing only the technology executive at a meeting 5 years ago. Durham not expected to bring charges tied to Intel assessment on Russia election interference. Okay. Law firm's Perkins Coie has already been tied to the Russia matter. Robbie Mook, Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign manager, said in 2017 he authorized Mark Elias, another attorney who until recently worked for Perkins Coie, to hire an outside firm to dig up dirt on Trump's connection with Russia in 2016. This led to British ex-spy Christopher Steele's discredited anti-Trump dossier. Remember that? Not that long ago. Nunes contended that the slam dunk indictment, which is 27 pages long, has solid evidence that Sussman was integral in helping the Clinton team develop the narrative of the secret back channel between Russia's Alpha Bank and the Trump Organization. The FBI investigated the claims and could not find any evidence to support them, but not before the media reported on the allegations and Clinton's campaign promoted them leading up to the 2016 presidential contest. Beyond the circumstantial evidence the California Republican said he already had, Nunes added, "We now have emails and communications. Clearly, Durham's done interviews in this." Well, that's good. We haven't heard anything for a while. We're getting kind of scared. He started up a long time ago, that Durham report, dude. Anyway. Indictments say paperwork shows that Sussman billed the Clinton campaign for time spent working on the Alpha Bank matter, as well as meeting with the FBI. The indictment also alleges that Elias, who served as a general counsel for the Clinton campaign, exchanged emails with the campaign manager, communications director, and foreign policy advisor about Russian bank allegations, among other claims. I would hope that this is not the only the first of several other indictments, said Nunes, adding that there are government officials he still wants to be held accountable. But he stressed that the new indictment does not look good for members of the Clinton campaign and others involved, some of whom have made their way into the Biden administration, such as White House National Secretary Advisor Jake Sullivan. Nunes said Durham is circling the wagons and would be surprised if Sussman did not reach a plea agreement. There was a conspiracy here, Newman says. You've heard me talk about this for many, many years. The Clinton campaign conspired with really bad agents and bad actors within the FBI and other locations. So this guy you've got lying to the FBI, we know people conspired to do this. Conspiracy is a major charge, and it can be very, very broad. That's why I would like to see, was this the only guy that did it? Is he going to be the fall guy for the Clinton campaign? We've seen that in history. Remember, we've seen in history the fall guys for the Clintons. Wow, that was an interesting quote. Didn't like the punctuation on that one at all. Durham was a U.S. secretary, U.S. attorney appointed by the former Attorney General William Barr to investigate the origins of the conduct of the Trump-Russia investigation and received special counsel status last year to continue his work into the Biden administration. So it's been at least 2 years. Durham's endeavor has long been criticized by the Democrats and legal observers who claim the inquiry is meant to undercut Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation into alleged ties between Trump's 2016 campaign and Russia, which amounted to nothing, by the way. Still, Trump and his allies have championed the investigation as a means to root out corrupt officials and settle political scores. Okay, well, so that's that. I mean, we hadn't heard anything. It was always talk about it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. So at least there's a little something out of that. I'm sweating profusely. I said I was cold when I first came in here, and I probably still am. And now I'm sweating profusely. Mental image of Midwood sweating profusely. All right, that's better. What time is it? Oh, God. It's moving real slow tonight, boys and girls. Actually, it's not that bad. So we got rid of the Clinton indictment. Is there anything that I wanted to do last week that I really didn't? The coming... Oh, this was interesting. This is out of MRC Culture. It's Gabriel Hayes wrote this on September 17th. Megadeth lead singer, "We're living in tyranny," calls out schools and medical businesses. The lead singer and guitarist for Megadeth and one of the founding members of Metallica, Dave Mustaine, is actually embracing the spirit of metal and sticking it straight to the frigging man. During a recent concert in New Jersey, Mustaine gave a speech about how Americans are living in tyranny right now. Mustaine has been writing songs about government tyranny, the military-industrial complex, and the New World Order for more than 30 years, so it's not a stretch. In a set on September 15th, a show featuring blistering metal classics and some new tracks, Mustaine made a point to share a moment with the crowd and bask in the unity that we've only been missing since the outbreak of the Wuhan virus. He remarked about the power of being in a raucous crowd of like-minded people away from the bureaucratic nags who demand that we stop the fun because it risks spreading coronavirus. Mustaine began by asking, "Is there anybody here besides me who's having a great friggin' time?" The crowd roared back affirmatively, flashing devil horn signs and cheering him on. From both the metalhead and the crowd, from both the metalhead and crowd, it's clear that we've been too long without a show. Let me see if this close this out. But I just want to tell you how great it is. Look around, you guys. Look to your right. Look to your left. Look how wonderful it is. He said, "We're all here together, and we're not fucking in bags, you know? We're not freaking out. We're not yelling at people. Where's your freaking mask?" he added. So I think we know how Dave Mustaine stands on the coronavirus issue. Issue. All right, let's see. What else do we got going on? Is this, what is this? I want to make sure what this, oh, this is Sputnik, out of Sputnik. Why isn't Sputnik opening? Open! Open, you bastard! I don't know what's going on, it's broken. Oh, here it is. Oh, I just went to the top. Crap! Accept and close. Accept and close. All right, well, it's more Trump stuff. Country has gone to hell. Trump urges U.S. voters to back America First GOP ahead of 2024 election. I was just having a conversation with, I was just having a conversation with Pimbo Woods about this a couple weeks ago. Has there been any solid, like, you know, drops from the president that he will be running in 2024? And I'm like, I said I don't think I'd do anything solid, but now stuff is starting to pop up. The former U.S. president has recently gotten back into the rally saddle as part of a larger effort to boost the attention of his supporters. And I think he had a rally tonight, by the way, ahead of the 2024 election cycle. However, despite the latest string of rallies, he has yet to announce whether he will officially contend in the looming presidential cycle. See? Former U.S. President Donald Trump urged U.S. voters to give their support to the Republican Party in upcoming elections should they want to keep their country, underscoring that a vote for the Democrats would send the nation into what he described as a downward spiral. The American president addressed his supporters during a highly anticipated Saturday rally in Perry, Georgia. Yeah, I guess this was, maybe today. Commenters had suggested that the event would see Trump declare his intent to run in 2024. However, that was not the case. The weekend rally touched on a variety of topics that ranged from the Biden administration's handling of Afghanistan withdrawal, urging the border crisis in Del Rio, and of course the Arizona audit reviews, which recently reconfirmed that President Joe Biden had bested Donald Trump. Trump took his first shot at Biden, the Biden White House, by laying straight into the latest developments in Del Rio, telling the crowd that the country is being turned into a migrant camp before he stated that American sovereignty is being extinguished by left-wing policies that have, according to Trump, allowed the migrant surge. What they're doing at this level, you're not going to have a country left by 2024, Trump told the crowd. No greater catastrophe. I don't know whether this is last Saturday or tonight. I think this might be last Saturday, because I think he had another rally tonight. He's getting around. This would never have happened if I were president, the former president added before going on to blast the criticism dealt to the Border Patrol agents who photographed violently attacking Haitians. No, this was tonight. I was going to mention that. Yeah, this was tonight. Yeah, the photos, it looked like something out of Planet of the Apes. And I've used that reference before, not in a good way. I hate to say. So it didn't look so great. But where the hell did all these Haitians come from? They didn't come from Haiti directly. I think they had papers from other South American countries. So they migrated from, I think this is how that played out, in case we're wondering. I think they migrated from Haiti to insert South American country here, or Central, probably South, not Central. And then when they heard that nincompoop in office wasn't going to be deporting Haitians by plane anymore, they all came a running because there was basically told that they wouldn't be deported. I'm pretty sure that that's the sequence of events, and you don't need a guy in a suit on television to tell you that, I don't think. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Anyway, data provided by the Pew Research Center has indicated that the border crossings at the U.S. southern border had been high during the Trump years, but those figures eventually went down under a sharp decline in fiscal 2020 as a result of new strategies that the administration used to handle asylum cases. Yeah, stay in Mexico. You stay in Mexico. Don't come here. Stay in Mexico until your case is adjudicated. Is there a translation for the word adjudicated into Mexican? I don't think there is. The Saturday rally also saw Trump's claim that the countries were emptying their prisons into the U.S. Every few months, hundreds of thousands are coming in, the former president told a cheering crowd. This is an invasion. Trump said that countries were emptying their... Yeah, that's horrible. Driving this message home, Trump said to his supporters that if you want to have a country left, you must not elect no Democrats and vote for only America First Republicans. That sounds right. Trump then blasted Biden over the chaotic pullout from Afghanistan, calling it one of the most appalling displays of incompetence, highlighting that his rally and had 13 empty seats in recognition to the service members who were killed in Kabul the days leading up to the August 31st withdrawal deadline. That's cool that they did that. And that's about that. What was I going to say? Yeah, forget what I was going to say. Oh, well, it's one of those nights. Let me get rid of this. And I just did the, just did that, didn't I? Speaking of Afghanistan, deep in hiding from the Taliban, Afghanistan Christians cling to faith. This is out of the Daily Signal. Tony Perkins wrote this, probably not that Tony Perkins, September 17th. They take turns staying awake, praying and walking the floor while others sleep, blissfully unaware, at least for a few hours, that they are being hunted. They have no passports, no visas, and very little of what they need the most of, hope. For these Christians, in a safe house deep in Afghanistan, time is running out. Together, they live in the fear of a single knock on the door of their hiding place from the Taliban. It happened so fast, Sarah said. We had many plans for preaching the gospel with other brothers and sisters. Now their plan is to just survive. Even that, you know, will be difficult. To the despair of rescue groups and humanitarian workers, the small population of Christians in Afghanistan has seemed to vanish almost overnight. Some have fled to the hills, others have retreated into the shadows while turning off their phones and hunkering down in whatever undisclosed locations they can find. Some have just gone missing completely. For people like Jean Marine Thrower, those are the ones that haunt her. People were going missing and getting killed every day. On the ground, her Afghan rescue crew hears the harrowing stories of desperate parents. We've had people shot, beheaded. They're taking the kids. And if you're on the run, they will find your family. They'll hurt your family, and they'll put the word out in the neighborhood that we got your brother or your son or your daughter. They cut off heads of two boys that were 9 and 10. The Taliban are executing Christians faster than her organization can find them. Starting with 300 3 weeks ago, we're down to 55. The orphans, if they're lucky enough to be left behind, are starving. Thrower talks about two girls who managed to hide after their parents were killed, but eventually got so hungry that they ventured out into the market. The Taliban found them, raped them, and beat them. In villages where the family doesn't have time to escape, the Taliban is going door to door, taking women and children. The people must mark their house with an X if they have a girl over 12, so the Taliban can take them. If they find a young girl and the house has not yet been marked, they will execute the entire family. While this White House is busy patting itself on the back for Afghanistan, calling it an extraordinary success 7,000 miles away, fathers are handing guns to their wives and daughters so that they can kill them for themselves if the terrorists come. Even hiding is a double-edged sword. Every day, one Christian told his American contact, CBN reported, "I have a phone call from a private number. A soldier warns me that if he sees me again, he'll behead me." The Taliban are tracking them, stalking them, warning them that they know where they are. Even within minutes, we have a number of people have charged their phone numbers, because it's simply not safe anymore. International Christian Concerts' William Stark lamented, "Others have gone completely dark, making it impossible for rescue workers to find them." "It's just an utter and complete humanitarian disaster," one activist said helplessly. The families fortunate enough to connect with an outside group are huddling in undisclosed hotels, listening to the manhunts outside. But they're running out of food and water. Thrower shakes her head. "They're afraid to leave the house for the past 10 to 12 days. But the cost is, for some of our groups, $10,000 to $15,000 a week. We have people in our organization paying, and I'm sending them money through Western Union. If we don't give them money, they won't be able to stay in this hotel for another week." Of all the teams, she says, all of the teams, she says, are going 24 hours without sleep. All the teams are going 24 hours without sleep, desperate to keep these endangered people alive. They all understand what one church leader has won. They will kill the known Christians to spread fear. Meanwhile, thousands of miles away, the Biden administration has already moved on. They're fighting abortion laws and ordering vaccine mandates, not giving a single thought to the thousands of people they abandoned and left behind. Whatever time they do spend on Afghanistan is reserved for the victory propaganda, declaring withdrawal with a huge success. Tell that to Jaladin and other Christians huddled in Kabul, wondering if this night will be their last. He's not afraid to die. Like many there, he's more afraid the world will forget them. "Pray for us," he asked, CBN reported. "We are praying that the Lord will help put his angels around our house for protection and safety." "God has a plan," another Christian leader in hiding insisted. "He knows what's best for his children in Afghanistan. The church has been united. The fear is the biggest thing. If leaders are afraid, the people in the church will be afraid. People are struggling to trust their own God. Through this hardship, the church will grow. But there will also be an exodus of Christians from Afghanistan." That was the Daily Signal. I don't even know if I feel like reading anything after that. That's pretty bummy. I'm probably not going to. What do I got? I got like 7 minutes left. Yeah, I think I'm going to shortchange it tonight and just play a tune and get out of here. I'm a little bummed after that last segment. Not surprising. We left savages in running the show in Afghanistan. We signed off on it. We left them plenty of equipment and plenty of other stuff. And now they're going to terrorize the rest of the country. So, and we're just going to stand by and go, okay, okie dokie, okie dokie. Anyway, all that being said, there's probably nothing I can add to that. I head over to midwood.com and you'll see the Midwood files. There's stuff there. There's we got I really knocked myself out with that last one. There's archives. You got my archives up there, and there's my social media, which I am minimally participating with these days. There's the favorites, which is where I cull a fair amount, if not all, of my news from. If you go up top, you'll see the 11LRNI little button. I think everything looks the same now on phones and on friggin' computers. Everything looks the same. So I can say that, and it'll be the same. So 11LRNI, I take you over to John Lightning's site, where you can find John Lightning Archives, and you can find Big Steve Cole Archives and Memoriam, and you can find Dave the Boogeyman Archives, as well as LF Midwood Archives, I suppose. You head all the way over to the right. Oh, actually, yeah, okay. I want to sweep again. I never mentioned this. Keep headed right. Head over to the right. You will find a contact that will get you in touch with us via email, should you care to drop us an email. Entirely probable and possible for you to do. And then all the way over to the right, the far right, although I suppose you'd find that amazing, or I suppose you'd find that amusing in some way, is our good friend Brad Reed, who is the farthest from the right, as you can maybe possibly get. Although he's over on the right side here, so go figure. I don't know. It's just a thing, man. I don't make these things up. Anyway, all this being said, I'm out of here. I'm going to play one more Grateful Dead tune in honor of Mr. Bob Matthews passing. I will be back next week, although my colon is, even as we speak, shouting at me. Even as we speak. That being said, I'm sure you didn't need to know that. But that being said, I'm going to play a tune and I'm going to get out of here. So we'll be back next week. Thanks for imbibing. Bye.
I lit up from Reno, I was trailed by 20 hounds. Didn't get to sleep that night till the morning came around. Sit out running, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Ran into the devil, baby, lonely 20 bills. Spent the night in Utah in a cave up in the hills. Sit out running, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. I ran down to the levee, but the devil caught me there. Took my $20 bill and it vanished in the air. I'm running, but take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Got two reasons why I cry away each lonely night. The first one's named Sweet Anne-Marie, and she's my heart's delight. Second one is prison, baby, the sheriff's on my trail. And if he catches up with me, I'll spend my life in jail. Got a wife in Chino, baby, and one in Cherokee. First one say she got my child, but it don't look like me. Said I'll run, but I'll take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Thank you.
Chino, baby, the one Cherokee. First one say she got my child, but it don't look like it. I said I'm running, but I took my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
You've been listening to the Midwood Files on Radio New York International. Thanks for listening.